Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fode, and this Best of Authors on Tour podcast was recorded live at the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Grief, when it comes, is nothing we expect it to be. It was not what I felt when my parents died. My father died a few days short of his 85th birthday, and my mother a month short of her 91st, both after some years of increasing debility. What I felt in each instance was sadness, loneliness, regret for time gone by, for things unsaid, for my inability to share or even in any real way to acknowledge at the end the pain and helplessness and physical humiliation they each endured. I understood the inevitability of each of their deaths. I'd been expecting, dreading, anticipating those deaths all my life. They remained, when they did occur, distanced and removed from the ongoing dailiness of life. After my mother died, I received a letter from a friend in Chicago, a former Mary Knoll priest, who precisely intuited what I felt. The death of a parent, he wrote, quote, despite our preparation, dislodges things deep in us, sets off reactions that surprise us, cuts free memories and feelings that we had thought gone to ground long ago. We might, in that indeterminate period they call mourning, be in a submarine, silent on the ocean bed, aware of the depth charges, now near and now far, buffeting us with recollection. My mother was dead, my father was dead. I would need for a while to watch for mines, but I would still get up in the morning and send out the laundry. I would still plan a menu for Easter lunch. I would still remember to renew my passport. Grief is different. Grief has no distance. Grief comes in waves, paroxysms, sudden apprehensions that weaken the knees and blind the eyes and obliterate the dailiness of life. Virtually everyone who has ever experienced grief mentions this phenomenon of waves. Eric Lindemann, who was chief of psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital in the 1940s and interviewed many family members of those killed in the 1942 Coconut Grove fire, defined the phenomenon with absolute specificity in a famous 1944 study. Quote, sensations of somatic distress occurring in waves lasting from 20 minutes to an hour, a feeling of tightness in the throat, choking with shortness of breath, need for sighing, an empty feeling in the abdomen, lack of muscular power, and intense subjective distress described as tension or mental pain. Such waves began for me on the morning of December 31st, 2003, 7 or 8 hours after the fact, when I woke alone in the apartment. I do not remember crying the night before. I had entered at the moment it happened a kind of shock in which the only thought I allowed myself was that there must be certain things I needed to do. There had been certain things I needed to do while the ambulance crew was in the living room. I needed, for example, to get a copy of John's medical summary so I could take it with me to the hospital. I had needed, for example, to bank the fire because I would be leaving it. There had been certain things I needed to do at the hospital. I had needed, for example, to stand in the paperwork line. I had needed, for example, to focus on the bed with telemetry he would need for a transfer to Columbia Presbyterian. Once I got back from the hospital, there had again been certain things I needed to do. I could not identify all of those things, but I did know one of them. I needed, before I did anything else, to tell John's brother, Nick. It had seemed too late in the evening to call their older brother, Dick, on Cape Cod. He went to bed early. His health had not been good. but I needed to tell Nick. I did not plan how to do this. I just sat on the bed and picked up the phone and dialed the number of his house in Connecticut. He answered. I told him. After I put down the phone in what I can only describe as a new neural pattern of dialing numbers and saying the words, I picked it up again. I could not call Quintana. She was still where we had left her a few hours before, unconscious in the ICU. But I could call Jerry, her husband of 5 months, and I could call my brother Jim, who would be at his house in Pebble Beach. Jerry said he would come over. I said there was no need to come over. I was fine. Jim said he would get a flight. I said there was no need to think about a flight. We would talk in the morning. I was trying to think what to do next when the phone rang. It was John's and my agent, Lynn Nesbitt. It was not clear to me at the time how she knew, but she did, and she was calling from a taxi on her way to our apartment. At one level, I was relieved. Lynn knew how to manage things. Lynn would know what it was that I was supposed to be doing. And at another, I was bewildered. How could I deal at this moment with company? What would we do? Would we sit in the living room with the syringes and the EKG electrodes and the blood still on the floor? Should I rekindle what was left of the fire? Would we have a drink? Would she have eaten? Had I eaten? The instant in which I asked myself whether I had eaten was the first intimation of what was to come. If I thought of food, I learned that night, I would throw up. Lynn arrived. We sat in the part of the living room where the blood and the electrodes and the syringes were not. I remember thinking as I was talking to Lynn that the blood must have come from the fall. He had fallen on his face. I had noticed in the emergency room that there was a chip on a tooth. The tooth could have cut the inside of his mouth. Lynn picked up the phone and said that she was calling Christopher. This was another bewilderment. The Christopher I knew best was Christopher Dickey, but he was in either Paris or Dubai. And in any case, Lynn would have said Chris, not Christopher. I found my mind veering to the autopsy. It could be happening as I sat there. Then I realized that the Christopher to whom Lynn was talking was Christopher Lehmanhaupt, who was the chief obituary writer for the New York Times. I remember a sense of shock. I wanted to say not yet, but my mouth had gone dry. I could deal with autopsy, but the notion of obituary had not occurred to me. Obituary, unlike autopsy, which was between me and John in the hospital, meant that it had happened. I found myself wondering with no sense of illogic if it had also happened in Los Angeles. I was trying to work out what time it had been when he died and whether it was that time yet in Los Angeles. Was there time to go back? Could we have a different ending on Pacific time? I recall being seized by a pressing need not to let anyone at the Los Angeles Times know what had happened by reading it in the New York Times. I called our closest friend at the Los Angeles Times. I have no memory of what Lynn and I did then. I remember her saying that she would stay the night, but I said no, I would be fine alone, and I was. Until the morning, when only half awake, I tried to think why I was alone in the bed. There was a leaden feeling. It was the same leaden feeling with which I woke. On mornings after John and I had fought, had we had a fight? What about? How had it started? How could we fix it if I could not remember how it started? Then I remembered. For several weeks, that would be the way I woke to the day. I see now that my insistence on spending that first night alone was more complicated than it seemed, a primitive instinct. Of course I knew John was dead. Of course I had already delivered the definitive news to his brother and to my brother and to Quintana's husband. The New York Times knew. The Los Angeles Times knew. Yet I was myself in no way prepared to accept this news as final. There was a level on which I believed that what had happened remained reversible. That was why I needed to be alone. After that first night, I would not be alone for weeks. Jim and his wife, Gloria, would fly in from California the next day. Nick would come back to town. John's nephew, Tony, and his wife would come down from Connecticut. Jose would not go to Las Vegas. Our assistant, Sharon, would come back from skiing. There would never not be people in the house. But I needed that first night to be alone. I needed to be alone so that he could come back. This was the beginning of my year of magical thinking.
That's all for this Best of Authors on Tour podcast. I'm Darren Fode, and this podcast was recorded live at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.